Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 102, recorded January 13th, 2011, the CES Postmortem.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ford, introducing the all-new 2012 Ford Focus Electric with voice-activated sync and My Ford Touch. Featuring gas-free power, zero CO2 emissions, and battery management technology that lets you go the distance. Learn more at FocusElectricPower.com. And by MailRoute. Businesses of every size use MailRoute. One user, 50,000 users, it doesn't matter. MailRoute will protect you from spam and viruses, simplify your life, and make your email usable again. Visit MailRoute.info for more details.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 102, ladies and gentlemen. Twitch at twit.tv. Well, that's the email if you want to ask us questions. And who are we? Where's Mr. Shroud? Mr. Ryan Shroud, master of benchmarks. Dude, are you completely lost in time zone hell at this point?
It feels like it. I'm trying to remember the last time we, because we didn't do an episode for Christmas, and I think I was out of town the New Year's week, and then we did a show in CES in Las Vegas, and now I'm back. I went home for a few days, and now I'm back out in San Francisco. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. Luckily, 3 hours is not as bad as going overseas or something, but.
I was ready to go New Year's Eve record a show, and you're like, "Are you high, dude? It's New Year's Eve." I'm like, "I'm packing my gear on the vacation."
That's true. And the whole everybody, I think they took that whole week off at the Twit Studios. So yeah, I know that there were some people that thought, "Well, I guess they were going to do 100 episodes, and that was it," because the 100th episode was the last one we did, and then we didn't do one for 2 weeks, and then we showed up again at CES. So
we're back, people.
We're back. We're back to a semi-normal schedule. Exactly.
So if you haven't seen it, episode 101, Ryan and Leo live at CES 2011, and a lot of, we're going to get into the post-CES wrap-up in a couple minutes, but... is that all you
so
have
much,
to say at this
it's
point?
So much stuff. It's like
CES. It's you know, 200,000 attendees, 12,000 products, 2,000 vendors, a zillion product introductions, and actually half a zillion of them were tablets running Android. I don't want to talk about that right now, because if I see another Android tablet, I will weep. Intel Core i7 2600 Sandy Bridge processor. This time it's the K versions, which are the overclockable performance versions. I'm going to try to speak.
K. Yeah, don't bother.
K for overclockable?
Yeah, so the K series indicates an enthusiast branded part that is overclockable. It's unlocked, basically. So, I mean, I kind of mentioned this on the PC Perspective podcast last night, but we've been talking about Sandy Bridge for so long that I kind of forgot that it actually didn't launch until CES.
Right.
Like, that's when the processors actually released. So I feel like we've been talking about it forever. But you know, if you go to PC Perspective, we posted like a full performance evaluation, the normal what you expect in terms of benchmarks and how it performs and all the different models and how they lay out. For kind of, you know, the geeky hardware enthusiasts that we cater to. Yes, the K series indicates an unlocked part, which means that the multipliers that affect the clock speed of the processor are fully unlocked. If you have a non-K series processor, they are, I think Intel calls it like partially unlocked, which essentially means you're going to be limited on how much overclocking you can do right. on non-K series parts, whereas you're only limited by the chip.
Frequency on the non-locked part, you can do the frequency on the locked part, you can do the frequency, the unlocked part, you can do the frequency and the multiplier.
It actually doesn't work that way anymore. It's kind of the same idea, right? So you've got a base clock, which on this architecture is 100 megahertz, and you have a multiplier that, you know, that's how the internals of the CPU work, and that's how you get your total, you know, 3 gigahertz, 3.2 gigahertz mm-hmm. clock speeds. So what people are There's the base speed, that base clock speed, you know, 100 to 150 megahertz type of thing. And then you wouldn't have to adjust the multipliers, and you'd have to adjust ratios to affect the memory speeds and keep everything under control. But with this processor, what we saw was you really could get the CPU over like 109 megahertz base clock, 108 megahertz base clock. Very minimal, which sounds really bad. It's, I don't know if it's bad, but it's different. Now, with the non-K-series parts, you can move the multipliers up as much as four steppings over what their default setting is. So if you have a CPU that can normally reach 3.7 gigahertz through the turbo mode technology, the turbo boost technology, then you'll be able to reach 4.1 gigahertz if you go into the BIOS and adjust the multipliers. And on the processors that I've seen and played with so far, it's so trivial to do that that it's almost, it doesn't make any sense to not do that. If you're comfortable going into the BIOS and doing anything, that you should go ahead and do that, because you don't have to adjust voltages. You don't have to adjust, you don't have to worry about having special cooling or anything like that to get 400 extra megahertz out of it. And from what I've read and what I've seen no reports of a processor that can't do that. So if you get a locked one, keep that in mind. The interesting part with the K-series processors is that the multiplier is completely unlocked. So if we have the base multiplier of – we're talking about – when I say base multiplier, I'm talking about really the turbo boost modes, because that's mm-hmm. what we're kind of watching – for how high can the processor go when it's got a full load, and then will it drop back down to the low power states to save you energy and cooling and that kind of stuff. I mean, we saw with these unlocked parts being able to push 50, 51 multiplier, which is a 5.1 gigahertz clock speed with almost no voltage changes, pretty standard air cooling. Right out of the box, ASUS was sending out kind of their press kits they do and say, hey, look, we're able to hit, you know, 5.6, 5.7 gigahertz. But it seems almost trivial at this point to reach 4.8, 4.9, 5 gigahertz with these types of things. And the benefit with this generation that you didn't necessarily get with the last generation is that will only run at the 5 gigahertz or the 4.8 gigahertz when you are, you know, doing encoding or when you're playing a game or when something is using the processor. When you're back at Windows, when you're back just browsing, it'll drop down to that 1600 megahertz low power, low heat state that a lot of the previous generation, the motherboards may or may not have been able to do that depending on which brand you had and all that kind of stuff. So it's interesting. It's interesting to say the least. I mean, and there's tons of other details here. We could talk about the integrated graphics and the differences that they have there performance-wise, but I think I'll leave some of that for our readers to go investigate for themselves, our listeners to go investigate for themselves, because when you get a new processor architecture, it's it can be really overwhelming. But the new integrated graphics is faster. It's, you know, but not significantly faster. You're not going to get rid of your $150, $250 graphics card if you want to play games. But if you had a $30 graphics card, you might not need that anymore. So
one of the interesting things Robert Heron and I were talking about on Techzilla that comes out on Monday night, Tuesday morning, is they still have the problem with true. They can do 24 frames per second, but they can't do the 23.967, you know, insert a number of decimal points in on the graphics on the Sandy Bridge chipsets, which is a real disappointment for people who are into home theater PCs who are serious cinephiles. You know, no big deal if you plan on doing 1080p, 60 frames or 30 frames per second, but you might want to reconsider Sandy Bridge as a home theater chip. Unless you plan on dropping a separate graphics card on top of that. That was actually, I was kind of surprised. I think Niantic was reporting that they will fix that in hardware for 2012. was like,
that's nice.
Guys. Yeah, I was kind of shocked and surprised about that one. So speaking of shocking and surprising, OCZ is walking away from memory modules. No more system memory for OCZ. They're going all... Am I correct on this? They're actually going to all hard drives?
Yeah, so all SSDs. I think they're still doing power supplies, maybe a couple of other smaller things. But yeah, I mean, OCZ came into the enthusiast market as a memory module manufacturer. They were one of the first, if not the first, to create overclockable modules, to market things as overclockable, to really kind of bin and sort memory modules based on what specific ICs they were using so that overclockers would be able to pay a little bit more and get that more overclockable memory. And over the years, what has happened to the memory market? We've seen the prices just collapse.
It's a commodity at this point. The numbers in the article.
Go ahead.
Oops. I was going to say, like, memory sees a drop from 22 million in 2009 to 6.2 million maybe in 2011. I mean, yeah. It seems like memory used to be a place like, I'm overclocking, I need the top of the line memory. And at this point, memory is kind of like, you know what I mean? It's overclocking doesn't seem to be as memory dependent. Upgrading to higher end memory isn't delivering much in the way of benchmarkable performance.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it used to be a real important part of what components you picked out for your system. And now at this point, even when I build a system for myself, you know, everybody sends me a lot of memory. And I'm just like, well, I'll take that DDR3 1333 that runs at, 999, whatever. Right? Because it's not making that much difference anymore with the processors and the integrated memory controllers that we have now. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, they are focusing on SSDs, which if you look at those same numbers in the news post we put up, are going the opposite direction.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's like a 7x increase or something like that in 19x. Revenue.
19x. From 2.1 million to 41 million.
Yeah. So, and with SSDs, you can get into the business side of things, which is not just better revenue, but way better margins and profit. So that's what they're going. It's not a big deal. It's just one of those things that's kind of surprising, and you kind of wonder in 2011, like, who's going to be next? Corsair, you see what they do. You know, they do cases and cooling and SSDs as well, and now they have speakers and that they announced at CES. All kinds of interesting things, and they still do memory, but you got to wonder for how long, or if they think, well, OCZ's out of it, now we've got that much more market share we can try to take back. It'll be a small market, low profit, but we can take more of it. So should be interesting through 2011 to see how that type of stuff pans out. We are going to touch on CES, some of the many, 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 many things that both Patrick and I saw.
Tegra 2 video? Where was Lightpeak? Shiny Aurora cases and oh so much more. Actually, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of stuff. We should thank our sponsor for today's episode.
We should thank the first sponsor. That is Ford, introducing the all-new 2012 Ford Focus Electric. This is actually really interesting. I didn't get to like see it at CES, but everybody was talking about it. I know Leo was excited. This is a 2012 Ford Focus Electric. It's an all-electric vehicle, no gasoline engine. This is not a hybrid. It's powered by a lithium-ion battery, high voltage capacity, obviously, higher capacity than the hybrid electric and plug-in hybrid vehicle batteries that they have already. It's recharged by plugging into a standard 120-volt electrical outlet or a 240-volt outlet if you get the electric vehicle supply equipment upgrade type of thing. I don't know if you'll be able to run it like off. Most people think of 240 as like the dryer power connection. So I don't know if you could just get one of those or if it's something different than that. But
well, the big deal for the 240 volt is it allows you to charge the vehicle much, much faster. You're looking for if you buy the optional box and have a 240 volt line, a dryer line, 220, 240 volt line in your garage, you're looking at 3 to 4 hour charge times for the batteries on that. And
that's awesome.
Ford's actually finally been texting about that. They're looking at about 100-mile range. I assume that's 100 miles if you don't like stand on the accelerator and do the top speed of 84 miles an hour everywhere you go.
That's a good idea. Don't do that.
That would be bad.
It does use the regenerative braking system, which enables to capture that energy while it's braking and store that for later use as well. It will offer the miles per charge. It's competitive with other electrical vehicles, as Patrick was mentioning there. More than enough driving power between charges for most work commutes, not all, but most, and getting around town. And depending on where you live, it could offer cheaper operation if electricity happens to be less expensive than gasoline, or if you happen to charge it at night when electric rates are lower. So the all new 2012 electric Ford Focus, feature sync, of course, with My Ford Touch. It responds to voice commands with touch controls, manages batteries, entertainment, climate control, phone, navigation, all the same stuff that we've told you about several times before. You can easily make calls, play music, manage the battery, all that kind of stuff. Sync understands more than 10,000 voice commands in total, so you can stay connected while keeping your eyes on the road and hands on the wheel. 10,000 is a lot. To learn more, all you have to do is go to focuselectricpower.com. No special URLs or codes for that, obviously. If they offer a discount, I'll be sure to let you guys know after I know. But the URL is focuselectricpower.com, and we appreciate their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And they supported basically the whole, a lot of the TWiT. Which I've mentioned at the outset, that if you never see another Tegra powered tablet, that'd be okay. But let's talk about Tegra for a second.
Tegra 2. Sorry, I just got all excited. That was a okay. NVIDIA's. They had a big press event on the press day, which is the Wednesday before CES. It was a lot of like, let's bring up our partner here, and let's bring, you know what I mean, those large, slow, glad handing of people who helped us in the process. Yeah. I felt really bad for everybody who had tried to use the original Tegra in a multimedia device and killed it, because the original Tegra could do 1080p full screen. And Tegra 2, 1080p full screen video, looking gorgeous. They basically grabbed a bunch of Adobe engineers and built flash acceleration into the hardware itself. I want to see real-world battery numbers for Tegra 2, because they're like,
I do as well.
You know, we're putting this into phones, and it's like, whoa, that's a very, very neat-looking phone, but it's going to be really useful if I have to carry around a car battery to get through the day. The part looks really interesting, but the incredible, amazing, weird thing was in like the last 2 minutes, we've had this long, drawn-out, not unlike my spiel right now, long, drawn-out discussion of Tegra 2 and gaming on Tegra 2. And look, here's Tegra 2-powered handset playing the exact – basically, they're having developers, gaming developers are like, we're able to use the same elements that we used in the PS – you know, the Windows and the PS3 version of this video game. And look, they're the same gaming experience on a handheld device, and everybody's like, oh, I want dual core performance on my portable device. Oh, this is kicking arms ass. And then all of a sudden, the man whose name I can never pronounce properly, who's the head of NVIDIA, comes out and is like, by the way, did you hear? Look at this obscure article on Forbes. There may be an ARMS version of Windows 7. And I bring that up because we've done a high-performance version of the ARM processor, and it's coming soon. And everybody's like, what? And then he, like, runs off stage.
Yes, it was very – I wasn't at the event. As you know, I was not let in. It was a little crowded at the event. But we had a couple of guys in there, and it was kind of, like, very last minute. Oh, and by the way, there might be a big revolution in the PC industry. See you guys later.
Yeah, and it's part of what's funny is like everybody thinks of ARM. It's like, okay, it's like the other, you know. People don't realize, first of all, that Apple's processor is essentially Apple purchased a company that does acceleration of ARM processors. And essentially the Apple-branded processor is a modified ARM processor. The thing that NVIDIA hammered on was that there have been more ARM processors sold. I guess they said the number that sticks in my head is more ARM processors sold in the last 2 years than in the previous 20 years of the history of the PC.
Wow.
Which That's is impressive. Like, yeah, I'm thinking there must be a lot of ARM processors and a lot of inexpensive phones. I'm trying to figure out how the math works on that.
They use ARM processors not just in phones, but in, you know, TVs and video processors and all kinds of other things. I mean, there
Blade
are...
Blade servers and watches. And
yeah. So the interesting thing about the NVIDIA announcement, it was more like of an announcement, hey, we've got this initiative we're working on, that they called it Project Denver.
Right.
And the idea is they're going to take that ARM architecture that runs in, you know, milliwatt power envelopes now. And they're basically saying, what can we do with this architecture if we take it up to a 20 watt or a 30 watt or a 40 watt power envelope? How much power can we get out of these architectures? How many cores can we put in here? How effective can those cores communicate? And it's not something that's ever really been done before. And obviously, this is NVIDIA's way of getting into the, we don't have a processor issue without having to go through the trouble of x86 licensing and buying VIA or something like that. And then, of course, Windows says, hey, by the way, we're making a version of Windows that runs on ARM. There's all kinds of other issues that have to come up with. All kinds of other software needs to be rewritten. Will drivers have to be rewritten? You're not going to get legacy software support with an ARM version of Windows. So it's not just a, well, okay, NVIDIA is going to be able to run on your laptop now. Skype, we won't be able to use Skype on it unless they make a new version for that. because it is going to be a native kernel, not a, you know, a mapped right. type of version there. So it's pretty interesting. I mean, we'll see a lot more on NVIDIA Tegra 2 phones. And you mentioned here the LG Optimus 2X, the whole term of superphone, which is kind of ridiculous if you ask me.
It's no longer a smartphone. It's a superphone, but only if it's powered by the Tegra 2 processor, the exactly. mighty dual cores of joy.
Yeah, that was actually kind of one of those funny, like, oh, you're trying to start a meme, get some viral action around your superphone. Yeah. But the LG Optimus 2 is the phone they were demoing there, and I was like, you know, 1080p full screen gaming looked good. 1080p full screen video looked good. You know, recording, I want to see too. What the battery life is on that. Yeah. But yeah, Project Denver was like, oh, well, that's not something I expected. Between that and then the announcement that came literally the Monday after CES was that Intel and NVIDIA have entered into a $1.5 billion agreement over 6 years where A, everybody shares patents or some subset of Intel and NVIDIA's patents are now shared, and B, more importantly, everybody drops their existing lawsuits. So Intel cuts a bunch of checks over the next 6 years. Oops, sorry.
I said that's the key, is the whole drop lawsuit thing. I don't think the whole patents thing at this point, you know, NVIDIA said, and they reiterated on the conference call, they're not going to make any more Intel chipsets. They have right. no desire to make Intel chipsets. They're not going to make an x86 processor. And Intel is not going to really integrate anything that NVIDIA has into their processors. I heard some people talk about, well, they're going to take NVIDIA technology and put it in Sandy Bridge, or the next version of Ivy Bridge, or something like that, and that's almost completely absurd. You know, it's not going to happen that way. And mm-hmm. Intel and NVIDIA is not going to put any IP that Intel has or anything like that into Project Denver. I mean, they're completely different architectures. Right. That's not really going to happen that way. It's more like, please stop bothering us. Here's $1.5 billion.
Which between like that check and the Tegra 2, if they get some design wins, and the ARM processor, if they get all, like, you know what, 5 weeks ago we were looking at each other going, so does NVIDIA still have a viable business model? And look, right. you know, obviously they were a step ahead of us. Speaking
that's
of
good.
Step ahead.
That's good.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, the
they better be. Yeah, you know, that would be bad if they weren't. I've been getting some questions. Like, I should get you into the studio so we can interview you before you head back to Ohio. Intel LightPeak, which a lot of people are like, should I wait to build my next PC until Intel LightPeak comes out, or should I go with USB 3.0? And it's like, A, USB 3.0 is here now. B, nobody knows where Intel LightPeak is. And C, I don't think it was anywhere even in Intel's booth at CES. Were they doing that because they don't want to confuse people with USB 3.0, or is Intel LightPeak just sort of fading off into the distance?
It was one of those things that I didn't really think about it during CES, but when I got back, I saw some story somewhere at some website that mentioned the words LightPeak, and I went, you know, I never heard word one about LightPeak when I went to go right. see Intel, when I went to go see any of Intel's partners. Didn't see any of the motherboard guys saying, oh, look, we've got the world's first implementation of LightPeak. It's going to be on a next generation chipset. You know, nothing like that. And I did see there was one report of an Intel executive talking about LightPeak, that it was ready for implementation, but that this first iteration was going to be based on copper, which basically means that the whole word, the whole term LightPeak doesn't really mean anything, because they're just going to transfer data like anything else, like through USB or through FireWire, copper, copper wire, not fiber optics anymore.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so you've got, that pains me, because it's like, what's the point? It's like, so you have LightPeak 0.5, later on you'll have LightPeak 1.0. Right. Do you think Intel's a little gun shy still from the original USB experience, where they're like, we came out with USB, there were millions of PCs over the course of 2 or 4 years, there were like 8 USB devices out there, until that fateful day when Literally, you could count the number of USB accessories on a hand and a half full of fingers until Apple came out with the iMac, and the iMac was slated with a group of USB accessories. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you went from this many USB accessories in the world to this many and growing. Right. Do you think Intel's a little gun shy from the introduction of USB? Are we going to force this on people? Is it going to be added cost on the motherboards? Or do they just not need the bandwidth at this point?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think they were developing this before USB 3. I mean, USB 3 runs at 4-5 gigabits per second. And Lightpeak, the first generation of Lightpeak, when they told us about it last year, was supposed to run at about 10 gigabits per second. So still faster, but only 2x faster, not an order of magnitude faster. And the cost of fiber optics is higher than copper, but there are a lot of advantages to fiber optics that we're not going to get. Longer ranges, no issues with data. With the range issue was there. I mean, you'll be able to run, a 100-meter cable. It's light. It's going to make it. We heard the rumors of, Apple's going to, release a laptop or a machine that's going to use Lightpeak, and maybe they're waiting for that again. But, Intel never stopped showing USB. They never stopped talking about USB during that build-up time. It just never gained traction. It's almost like they just decided not to talk about it anymore until this last little
John, did we just lose Ryan?
Oh, am I here?
Oh, there you are.
Oh.
You started moving very slowly and your voice started. At least at this end. Sorry.
But
you were saying, though, they were still talking about USB came out, adoption was slow, but they were still talking about it the entire time.
Yeah, and it's just weird that they haven't done this. So, if we don't hear anything between now and the Intel Developer Forum, which is in September or end of August, then we might have some problems. And then especially if we don't hear anything at the next IDF, then we definitely have problems. And people who were exceptionally interested in Lightpeak. I know Leah was one of those guys when he heard about Lightpeak and all the ideas that Intel had for it and what you could connect. And you have one cable coming in your system for your display, your keyboard, and your external storage and all that in one deal. Great idea. It just needs to be implemented. And we didn't see any of that. So.
Yeah, I imagine at this point, between DisplayLink and DVI and HDMI, I imagine monitor vendors are probably a little shy about integrating yet another port. Okay, let's see. Lenovo has tablets. Toshiba with their unnamed tablet, which is the number one traffic segment we did from CES was Toshiba's unnamed tablet up on YouTube.
Nice.
Asus, you got hands-on. Did you get hands-on with their new tablets, or, mm-hmm, or were mm-hmm. they kind of behind the fence? What did you think? What do you think? And did you get a chance to get hands-on with Android Honeycomb, the new version of Android optimized for tablets? I don't think – I think the list of people who got to touch those tablets is 3 or 4 people long.
Yeah, I didn't get to see any of that. The tablets I saw from Asus were kind of using the Asus software, so you didn't really know what was going on in the background. I'm sure they weren't Honeycomb. The tablets were nice. The form factors were nice. Probably my favorite one was the one they called the E-Pad Transformer. It's a standard tablet, 7-inch tablet. I don't have one here, but I'm holding up my hands. Android powered, Tegra 2 powered. And they said between 8 and 10 hours of battery life on it of use. But if it came with a keyboard dock kind of thing, so that it had a full-size QWERTY keyboard that you kind of docked it into it. And so it looked like a netbook, a laptop at that point. But in the keyboard was also another battery that doubled the capacity or the lifetime of it, to 16 or 20 hours of use. That was probably the most practical one I saw. They had a big 10-inch. No, they had a 12-inch. The E-Pad EP121 that was a Core i5 CULV part, Windows 7 based, Wacom pen tablet type of thing. Really high quality. Probably not the market that most of these tablets are going to fall into. Kind of the what can we get for $500 or $600? This is going to be significantly more expensive. But they had some good stuff. But, you know, the Motorola, what was that one? The Zoom X-O-O-M. Right. You know, I mean.
That was another one that got big traffic for us. People are really excited about Motorola getting kind of back on their game. Yeah. And I was like, Yeah, but there was, and I'm trying to think, I mean, there were like 15 vendors that I've never heard of. Yeah. And I say that with love and affection because any one of them could be the next, you know, HTC or something. Not sure. To take anything away from HTC, but, you know, I think Vlieve was one of the ones we saw. And then there were a couple where you're just like, oh, wow, somebody's building a tablet. You know, they, like you're looking at somebody's tablet demo and all you can think is, I wonder if this will ever ship.
One of the things that we wanted to do was pull out the Tegra tablet demos from last CES and show them to NVIDIA and be like just point at them and be like, hey, what about that? Where's that? Is that this? Is this going to happen to that? What's going on here?
No need to be mean, Ryan.
I know. It's called holding them to the fire or something like that. I don't know. So 4G, you've mentioned in here something about latency. Are you talking about physical latency, product latency?
I had a funny moment. We went to shoot. They're doing demos in the – okay, first of all, the only people who got a real demonstration of, at least in public, of Android Honeycomb were people who were at Verizon's press conference where all of a sudden after like – it's funny because you're talking to some of the largest PC vendors in the world. And they're like, yeah, we're building a tablet for Android Honeycomb, but the only company that gets to touch Android Honeycomb is, you know, Motorola. So I'm wondering if like Motorola cut a check to get the exclusivity on Android Honeycomb. Literally, because I'm talking to some guys that are – pretty serious players in the mobile world, and they're like, yeah, but we haven't seen Android Honeycomb yet. And I'm like, that's gotta suck, dude. So all of a sudden, in the middle of the Verizon press conference, out comes Google to walk people through Android Honeycomb. They're using the Asus tablets as a demo, and they had gaming going on over the 4G network. They're doing Asphalt 6 and Dungeon Defender between the Verizon booth and the NVIDIA booth. They had tablets in the Verizon booth and the NVIDIA booth. They also had Alienware M11Xs in the, Verizon booth, showing gaming going over the wireless network, which is a big deal. If you're a gamer, you know, you could do Sudoku over a wireless network or maybe some like Bejeweled type thing. But Twitch gaming, driving games, first-person shooters do not work well over most existing 3G and 4G networks because the latency is so high, easily 100, 120, 180 milliseconds. And Verizon's claiming that they're going to – they've the kind of numbers you're seeing now, like 30 milliseconds, you'll be seeing after they ship this in volume, which will also happen after they start the pricing and after they really admit whether or not there's going to be a data cap on 4G service. I'm hoping there's no data cap on Verizon's 4G service for obviously selfish reasons.
there is on this one, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, people have been, I can't decide if people are flirting with that, you know, in articles and blog entries because they think it's generating traffic or because there's an actual possibility that Verizon's going to do what Sprint did, which is have no data cap on 4G.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that on the 4G modems, like the one I'm using right now when recording this, there's a 5 gig per month option or a 10 gig per month option, but there is no unlimited data per month option. And while in CES for 5 days, I used about 3 gigs of data. I mean, I was using it a lot, video uploads and downloads and stuff like that.
Right.
But that's troublesome. So,
you know, Sprint doesn't have the latency, but I have no data. When I'm connected to 4G, I've got no, I don't pay for data on Sprint, exactly. Which I used to have with my Sprint 3G modem until they got rid of the unlimited data option on that. But let's not talk about that or I'll get angry. Intel isn't scared of Windows on ARM.
Yeah, so we mentioned earlier something about Intel paying out like a $1.5 billion fine a settlement with NVIDIA.
Hush money.
And then today they announced their earnings. Again, another record. It seems like every quarter we have to announce this. This is a quarter. Their sales were $11.46 billion with net revenue of $3.39 billion.
Wow.
And as a friendly reminder, Josh writes on our site that a good quarter for AMD is a gross revenue of $1.6 billion compared to 11 $3.4 billion and a profit of about $100 million versus $3.39 billion. So Intel has a lot of money. Yes, they've been paying a lot of fines, settlements, that type of thing. It's not really going to hurt them too much. And then during that same earnings conference call, yes, apparently Intel CEO Paul Otellini was asked directly about what do you think about the ARM architecture now that Windows is coming to ARM? Is this a threat to what you guys have going or what your goals are in the low power processor market? And he basically says that there's plus and minus for Intel. The good is that it creates more opportunity for Intel's low power and high performance chips to get into a lot more systems. So once Windows is if Windows becomes a viable solution for ARM architecture at low power consumptions, maybe we'll see new versions of Windows on phones that way. It would immediately allow Intel's x86 version or x86 architecture to work with the same or basically the same operating system at similar levels. This obviously all depends on Intel being able to get the power levels to where they need to get them to compete with ARM again. So the bad obviously would be that they won't be able to do that and Intel will be left behind. But, you know, Intel still has the ability to, I mean, even Intel could build ARM architecture processors if they wanted to. I think that would be really odd for them to start licensing things like that out. But it's possible. AMD is proposed or supposed to be mulling that idea around as well, using the ARM architecture to jump into that mobile computing space before their x86 designs can really get there. But yeah, apparently Intel is not scared of Windows on ARM.
I don't think Intel would admit it, even if you
wouldn't expect them to say that they were. Oh yes, we're very worried about that, investors. Please drop our stock price.
Yeah, you know? I'm like, I know. I wonder if Intel though, if Otellini's going like, God, we should have bought that stupid ARM architecture when we had the chance.
I mean, they probably could have bought them for $200 million like a decade ago or two decades ago or something like that. That
they could probably still buy them if they wanted to.
Yeah. Let's see. We're going to get into at least a handful of emails. We did have a lot of stuff to talk about, obviously, with CES and all the hardware releases and our time away, et cetera, et cetera. But before we jump into the emails, we're going to thank our second of today's sponsors, and that would be MailRoute. Businesses of all size use MailRoute. One user, you, 50,000 users, lots of people. It doesn't matter. MailRoute will protect you from spam and viruses, simplify your life, and make your email address usable again, which that's definitely a plus. MailRoute is a secure hosted service that filters virus and spam for companies of any size. Whether you're a single user, company with tens of thousands of employees, MailRoute can eliminate those viruses and spam and while reducing the load on your own email servers, lower your costs, and help make email usable again. Typical MailRoute customers see a 95% reduction in their inbound email volume with virtually no false positives. That's kind of indicative of spam rates, I guess. 95% reduction in inbound email. Leo loves MailRoute. He's been using the service for his domains for more than 6 years now and has been his top choice for spam and virus filtering all along. Tom Merritt started using MailRoute, and now he can use email domains that he'd given up on being able to use as hopeless. Too much spam coming in. Tom Johnson is the founder and CEO of MailRoute, started one of the very first companies in the market back in 1998, known as FrontBridge. It was acquired by Microsoft and still offered as the Microsoft Exchange hosted services. Tom wasn't done, though. Too many good ideas, apparently, that he couldn't stand to go to waste, so he started MailRoute, the next generation of mail filtering technology. There's nothing easier than mail filtering with MailRoute. You do have to own the domain, though. That's kind of the key here. There's no hardware or software to install. You just sign up with MailRoute and then change the MX records for your domain to start your mail flowing through them, and then they do all of the work. So if you know what an MX record is, or even if you don't, but you know you host your own email, or you know that you own your own domain, this can even work through Google's email services as well. This will all work out for you. The You can get a lot more information and details if you go to mailroute.info. You can sign up. As a TWIT listener, you'll get 10% off discount off the life of your account. Small business accounts start at just $2 per user per month. And because of demand from the TWIT community, MailRoute has added a new service for individual users as well, less than $30 per user per year for single users. Visit mailroute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Tom and Leo use. And, of course, we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thanks, MailRoute.
You say route, I say route. Which one
is that? Let's go with route.
Okay. So we got a ton of emails because we had been backlogged a week off, week at CES, we didn't do anything. So do not be surprised if your particular email does not get read today. And plus, we have a little bit shorter time span here. But please keep sending the emails in, twitch@twit.tv. I guess let's just jump into some.
Ravenit writes in. He says, love the show. I'm a regular listener. Thank you, Ravenit. My question is about the massive cost of replacing ink on my Canon IP4850 printer. My wife mainly uses it to print out photos of the kids for photo albums and the odd DVD cover. Three kids and many gigabytes of photos. Someone mentioned I should use a continuous ink supply system, or CISS for short. Have you had any experience in these systems, and will they give me the same quality as my current inks? As the cost to first set up is around $140 Australian dollars, it's worth more than my printer, so I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing. As well you should. So printers aren't quite given away, but they basically sell printers because they make the money off of the ink. Per ounce ink for your printer is worth more than
liquid gold,
although it's kind of hard to tell at this point because gold's so high, but it's worth more than Chanel number 5. It's worth more than, like, you know, make a list of, you know, unicorn tear drops are probably worth less per ounce than the ink in your printer. What's really frustrating, if you've ever had a chance to cut open the ink cartridge in your printer, you'd be shocked at how little ink is in there, because basically they're shooting incredibly tiny drops onto the page. The continuous ink supply systems are really cool if you A, use it every day, and B, the ink you're being supplied works well with the paper you're being supplied. If you go to like Epson or Canon or HP or anybody that makes printer, they're going to be like, if you don't use our standard formulations of ink, the world will fall apart and a black hole will open and suck you and your family in first. In reality, the compatibility between the inks and general papers, you know, photo papers can get a little irritated by using the wrong inks, but the formulas should be pretty good. I would suggest, one, look around online because there are continuous ink systems available for somewhat less than 140 AU, at least if you shop around. I would really think, you know, here in the United States, you can go to a Walgreens, which is a local drugstore that's nationwide, and get ink cartridges refilled. There's a chain in the U.S. that's also in Australia called Cartridge World, which will basically, you recycle your cartridges, they refill it. There are DIY ink refilling kits, which work great if the ink is compatible with your paper and you don't do something really awful like squeeze the bottle at the wrong time and blast 18 pounds of ink all over your face.
That's not good.
no, that's a friend of mine had a very horrible night with a bottle full of ink. But I would start with looking for like a Cartridge World in your area, checking, you know, I don't know what the Australian version of like Costco or Walmart or Walgreens or, you know, any of these chains, you know, do a Google search for your area with cartridge refill. Because I would start with doing cartridge refills or getting your cartridges refilled by a professional before I would invest in the full on. Because the systems are pretty crazy because you end up with the ink cartridges in the machine with a bunch of tubes running out of them to a bunch of giant ink wells with, you know, individual ink portions in there. And the cool thing is, you know, the worst thing is if you've got one of those inkjet printers where it's got like four, and they don't do this too often, but if you have four colors integrated into one ink cartridge, and you, of course, the kids are printing homework, you run out of black, you know, you're down to zero on black, and, you know, you're still at like 80% of the other three colors. The printer companies realized that it was just a bad thing to do to people, and from the most part they stopped. But I would look for cartridge refills, and, you know, if you're blowing through like a set of cartridges a week, then I'd start thinking about
doing the continuous ink system. Because they're, you know, you need to put the printer in a safe place and mount the ink on the continuous ink system on a nice little frame. And you need
you
to
don't
use
want that
it a
ink
lot.
Falling over.
No, you don't want the kids running into it. You don't want people playing ball in the house around it. You don't want to, if your cat sleeps on your printer, don't go with a continuous ink system unless you want a really colorful tie-dye kind of cat. But I would start with cartridge refills. They're basically selling the printer as cheap as possible because they know they're going to get you on the ink.
I have bought new printers rather than buy ink at least a handful of times. Absolutely have done that. We got an email from Ben about hard drive protection. He says he recently purchased a USB docking station for SATA drives, and he's really happy with it. He's planning on just bare drives for any external storage that he wants rather than getting pre-enclosed ones. Sounds cheaper. My question is, do I need to worry about storing them properly? The one drive I've bought so far, I just keep up on a shelf and the same anti-static bag and bubble wrap it was shipped to me in. However, I've seen protectors being sold at Newegg, and he gave us a couple of links. Do you think there's something to the idea of buying some plastic to put unattached hard drives in, or something else I should do to protect these drives from dust, etc.? He's a bit skeptical, but when he considers that he wants to carry and or ship these drives around now and then, my cursor inches towards that buy button so that I can have something more than packing material and those flimsy bags on hand. Thanks for the show. Enjoys Twitch every week.
Yay.
So the
hard drive condoms.
Yes, exactly. It's interesting because Leo does this. This is how Leo stores all the video content, right? He's got an eSATA-based hard drive dock that he swaps out 1.5 terabyte drives at. And I think he just puts them in a static bag and puts them on a shelf. He's kind of crazy. I mean, your idea of putting them in the static bag, putting them in the bubble wrap that they came shipped to you in, to me seems more than reasonable, but it seems less than ideal if you're going to have multiple of them over years, right? You know, bubble wrap stack on top of bubble wrap on top of bubble wrap doesn't sound that secure to me. So sometimes these little cases that might allow them to be stacked or grouped together a little bit easier. But I mean, when I get bare drives shipped to me from Newegg or Amazon or whoever, they're in a static bag and they're wrapped in bubble wrap. And then they're usually flopping around a bigger box, unfortunately. I tend to think that's probably okay and it's free. But you should use Carbonite too, or something like that. I just don't like the idea of trusting hard drives completely forever.
Right.
Like just one hard drives
are not. Hard drives aren't the best long-term storage. Basically the zeros and ones, the magnetic coating on the disk that represents your data can fade over time. It's one of the things that high-end RAID systems or devices like the Drobo do. They essentially exercise the drives and kind of rewrite the zeros and ones to make sure they don't fade over time. I've got friends who do huge video editing projects. Well, they'll capture all their A-roll and B-roll onto hard drives, and they'll routinely have four or five drives sitting on their desk, and they'll slide them in and out of a dock. You know, if you don't let, you know, if the kids don't play in your office, if you don't live in earthquake country, you know, hey, you can leave them out there. But yeah, if you know, somebody bumps into your desk and four drives slide off and you lose a year's work, you're going to feel kind of stupid. It was kind of funny, behind somewhere as I crawled up on the Twit stage at CES, there was a box full of WeebTech drive enclosures, but I think they were the sort of the big ones designed for slots. I couldn't, I obviously wasn't going to start digging around the hardware there when I'm supposed to be on the stage. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, you can buy this, you know, I was kind of like, I called them drive condoms because you look at them and it's really what they look like. They're these strange blue wrappers. I like the Bitech hard drive protection box a little better. What I really like is the shipping containers, and I probably, because I've bought five hard drives at a time, you've got it, you put your little, you know, your zero static bag goes on the hard drive, and the hard drive goes in this slot in a foam rubber case. I'm sure if you dig around on the Pelican website, there's some sort of Pelican case you can put them in. But yeah, I mean, you know, a $3, you know, slip-on rubber thing, I don't really see that doing a lot to help your hard drives. I think putting them, you know, in a case or the, you know, yeah, put them in the original wrapper, put them in bubble wrap, put them on a, you know, the bottom of your file cabinet near the floor. Mostly, you know, I've probably been way too casual with hard drives. As Ryan's mentioned, you know, backing things up to a central server is a really good idea, and even better if you live in earthquake, forest fire, tornado, you know, flood country, backing up.
If you live anywhere where nature happens.
Yes. And when we say nature happening, we don't mean like, oh, look, the leaves are turning. We mean like, you know, pissed off Mother Nature stomping on humanity type stuff.
Exactly.
Then you'll be like, so that's what they meant by using Carbonite for an offsite backup, because then your data will be safe in the cloud.
Nice.
All right.
Nice.
Every show I work on, it always comes down to, you know, have you backed up today? Why not? You know, if you backed up today, when your hard drive dies tomorrow, you'll still have your data. Arno wants a new notebook with discrete graphics, just to change the subject before I go off on this again. Says, I'm looking to buy a new ultra-portable PC laptop. I want it to be light. I want 5 hours of battery life and up. I want no DVD drive or no DVD drive necessary. 13-inch or smaller LCD, good CPU and GPU performance. From what I see, there are two choices. Intel Core i whatever ULV with a fast CPU and a slow GPU, or an AMD Fusion with a slow CPU and a fast GPU. It says, I'm not comfortable buying a laptop with just an Intel HD graphics, since I often had problems watching HD video with Intel integrated graphics. That's not an unusual experience.
Yeah.
But I'm also not sure about the speed of the Fusion CPU part. I don't do gaming on the laptop, but dual monitors working with HD video playback or flash video streaming in HD, and sometimes some decoding with Handbrake. It has to function without problems. Do I really have to buy another Sony Vaio for over 2,000 euros with discrete graphics cards, since I had so many problems with my last one? I would look at some of the Dell gaming machines. I love Alienware's M11X. It is not a cheap computer, but it's a hell of a lot less than 2,000 euros. Sadly, Alienware did not have, they had a chrome plated Aurora platform, the next generation Aurora platform at CES. Alienware's M11X is not what you would call a subtle notebook.
No. It will get attention.
But it's got, they did some really interesting things, because they've got discrete graphics included, but you can turn off the discrete graphics and use the integrated graphics. So you get like 10 hours of battery life, like 3 hours at full-on gaming from hell. It weighs less than 5 pounds. It's got an 11-inch screen, which for a lot of portable applications is pretty ideal. Getting something that small with a super high-powered CPU is not the easiest thing to do. Is Lenovo of anything to think of?
So I would love to be able to tell him about a Sandy Bridge notebook, but to get like a 13-inch or less, you might be able to see some. All the first Sandy Bridge notebook processors released are quad-core variants. So what you need is a dual-core variant to get into that 5 hours and up battery life, 13-inch and smaller screen. That will probably be in March when those start to come out. That's going to be his best option. And I would say that that generation of Intel HD graphics, he's not going to have any problems watching HD video. And if he's not doing gaming on the laptop, dual monitors, not going to be a problem. HD video playback, flash video, it's not going to be playback on both, because of the higher performing processor as well as the higher performing integrated graphics. The Fusion machines, I think, are going to be little bit apparently, as soon as he mentioned encoding with Handbrake,
right.
I was a little bit leery of that. I mean, it'll be able to do it. It's not like it'll crash or something like that. And the HD video playback will be an issue with that. But remember what the target audience of Fusion is. That is like, we're going to be better than Atom, not we're going to compete against Core i5 or the Sandy Bridge parts.
Yeah.
But you'll be able to get it really cheap. Right, I mean, I saw the first Acer Aspire. It's a 15-inch AMD Fusion laptop up for pre-order on Amazon. It was $470. So I don't think it was getting 5 hours of battery life, but it was a decent machine, especially for $470. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sitting here trying to find if there's like, there's a 11.6 inch Pavilion, but that's a dual core E350 AMD Pentium R processor.
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's still like, if you can deal with a 14 inch screen instead of a 13 inch screen, the XPS 14 starts at 900 US, includes NVIDIA yeah. graphics on that, has enough oomph to do 3D gaming. It's got a decent CPU. But yeah, it's the smaller machines are always the last one to get the high performance parts, usually very because true. The larger machines have the super much faster parts. So yep. Email from Sean about holy crap, buy a new hard drive, or email from Matt about confusing NVIDIA GPU naming schemes.
Let's do Sean.
Okay. Got a question for you, says Sean. Go ahead.
Oh, I'll go ahead and take it. He's got a question sure. for you. He's been running a Seagate Barracuda 1.5 terabyte hard drive for just short of 2 years now as my primary disk. Three equal partitions, first being the operating system. This past fall, he was having some blue screens of death, or is it blue screen of deaths? I think I'm going to go with blue screens, which I traced back to the RAM being set to weird voltage. However, on my way to finding my memory issue, I came across a Kronos drive monitor, which much to my surprise told me that my Western Digital 2 terabyte drive was at 100% health and my Seagate drive was at 47%. This number has since fallen to 40% as of today. The program reports, quote, reallocated sectors count, smart attribute, reported bad block on the drive. Increasing number of bad blocks may be an indicator of imminent drive failure.
Drive failure.
And also spin retry count was another error he got. This may indicate problems with the motor or bearings in the hard drive. Should I be horribly worried, or are they just trying to scare me into using their backup programs? Also, can you suggest any freeware to use in these concerns? I think you should be terribly worried.
Yeah, smart's not the most reliable indicator of a drying hard drive, but you know, man, when you're looking at, like, you know, basically reallocated sectors means the hard drive's going, wow, that sector went bad, I should move this data over here. Wow, that sector went bad, I should move this data over here. And oh my right. goodness, I'm going to move a whole lot of data somewhere else in the drive. That's bad. You know, mm-hmm. spin retry count basically means it's if memory serves, it's spinning up and trying to function. you know, when yes, when good. Smart tells you that you know, life as you know it is going away in your hard drive, step one, back everything up. Step two, either, you know,
yeah.
properly dispose of that hard drive and buy a new one. Or if you're feeling adventurous, you can, you know, back off your, you know, image your operating system, back your data off of it and try running it. You know, there's a part of me that's like, oh gosh, you know, it's only 2 years old. It shouldn't be dying. And quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, it shouldn't be dying.
It might still be under warranty.
Might still be under warranty. That's actually a really yeah. good point. Calling up Seagate and being like, dudes, dead, fix, only being polite and gentle. But the, yeah, probably shouldn't call them up quite like dude, fix, but yeah.
I would say smart data is probably guilty of having a lot of false negatives where your drive yeah. will die, but you'll get no warning. But if smart mm-hmm. is telling you your drive is dying, you should probably listen to it. It's your data.
Right.
It's a lot of stuff that's really important to you. Always keep that in mind. So
yeah, back up your data now and then decide whether or not you want to buy a new hard drive.
Right.
Like Ryan, I think both of us would be like, you know, back my data up, call Seagate, think about buying a new hard drive. I mean, the upside is you can buy a, you know, 1.5 terabyte hard drive for like $40 now. Yeah. I'm kidding. It's probably like $70 right now. Which is so painful nice. Given what I paid for a stack of 1 terabyte drives last year. Okay, Anthony, failing battery life or Nick burning in LCDs? I think actually, do you mind if we do Anthony's question?
That's fine.
Okay, Anthony says, I used to get 3.5 hours out of my battery on my Asus. Now I'm only getting 2 hours out of my battery. I've had the computer for over a year. If I got a new battery and installed an SSD, do you think I could see a large jump in battery life? Before I got a new battery installed in SSD, I would think to myself, A, you know, have I drain this battery every day for the last 300 days? B, am I constantly leaving my notebook plugged into the wall and charged up all the time and only like once every 6 or 10 weeks actually letting the battery run down? Because you need to exercise your battery. It's amazing what sometimes inside of your BIOS, there'll actually be sort of a, you know, exercise your battery program. Other, you know, the simplest thing to do is just run your notebook full steam ahead, you know, playing video games, whatever you can do with it. Run 17 applications simultaneously until the battery goes to zero and the computer cuts out, and then charge it all the way up from scratch. It's not unusual to either use, you know, to either do that or to do the exercising my battery with a really cool program in the BIOS and find you picked up a chunk of battery life. That said, notebook batteries wear out. They have a finite number of charges. The closer you get to that finite number of charges, the less long the battery life is, and it's really frustrating. But, you know, if you get to 2 years and still have the original battery life out of your notebook, you're doing amazing. For most people, especially if you're constantly, you know, basically, you know, there's a really good explainer. Apple's actually done, because Apple had so much trouble with batteries on the iPhone in the early days, the iPod, they've overcompensated by putting tons of great articles on the support pages of the Apple website, basically talking about best practices with batteries, how battery charging work. You know, taking the battery down to 50% two times is roughly the equivalent of taking the battery down to 100%. You do need to drain your battery down to as close to zero as you can at least once a month. You know, use the proper power chargers for it. Don't leave it constantly plugged in. At least once a month, unplug it from the wall and let it run down to zero. Try that first. If that doesn't work, because basically the rule of thumb is the cheaper the notebook, the cheaper the battery, the shorter the battery life. So when you get a bargain notebook, you often get a bargain battery, and you often end up with really frustrating battery life after a year, year and a half. A year is a little on the early side for exhausting a battery, but your batteries, when I think of exhausted, you're looking at like 30 minutes of battery life instead of that 3.5 hours. But so you're kind of on a nice steady decline, getting down to an unusable battery. That is perfectly normal. It is totally frustrating given what you probably paid for a notebook. Try zeroing the battery out and recharging it first. If that doesn't work, I would be shocked and amazed if getting a brand new battery didn't up your battery life considerably. SSD, not going to add a huge amount of battery life, but it will add amazing performance. Your resume from, I can hear Ryan laughing. He's like, oh, still bitter about taking the SSD out of your notebook, aren't you, Mr. Norton?
That's right.
the SSD is more valuable in terms of, you know, starting up the notebook, resuming from suspend. It makes resuming from hibernation super practical. Resuming from hibernation instead of suspend will actually extend your battery life, because, you know, every time you close your lid on your notebook, hibernation uses less energy than suspend. So that's something to definitely be thinking about. The performance jump is more intense than the battery life jump when moving to an SSD. Also, turn the backlight on your screen down as far as you can go. It's amazing what dimming your screen will do for battery life, because that is the number one consumer of power in your mobile device.
All right. I have a confession to make here. We had a contest for the 100th episode, which was like 4 weeks ago or something like that, as we've already discussed several times. And I had picked the winners for these two motherboards. Unfortunately, that post-it note was left on my desk at home.
Oh no.
So and my wife's out, so I called her right before the show started to see if she could read off the names and that kind of stuff. So I'm not going to try to recite it from memory. So I will just say that congratulations, winners. You will be notified next week. I'll let everybody know next week.
Oops.
So sorry about that. Yeah.
And the chat room went wild.
Congratulations, somebody.
We'll let you know who you are next week. It's still an awesome contest.
It might be you. It could be you. Keep listening next week.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. I'm Patrick Norton.
Oh, goodness. Oh,
boy. Should we do one more question, or should we just call it at this point?
We got time for one more, I think. Let's do one more question.
You got
an interesting one we can find here. Let's see.
User files, Z68 chipset, SSDs in RAID, Sandy Bridge upgrade,
That's a great question. Let's read that one because I think I had two or three that were very similar to that.
Okay.
And that's one that is easily addressable.
Sandy Bridge upgrade?
No, the SSDs in RAID. This is from John. He says, I picked up an OCZ Vertex 2 120 gig SSD as an upgrade to an older Q66 system with an NVIDIA 680i motherboard. Down the road, I might be interested in getting a second 120 gig Vertex 2 drive with the intention of running RAID 0. I'm wondering if onboard controllers are going to bottleneck with an SSD RAID 0 configuration. Would I be forced to purchase a $500 RAID card to see any performance benefit, or do any newer motherboards offer sufficient onboard controllers? Would there be any other issues with using onboard RAID with SSDs? A while ago, I tried a hard drive RAID 5 configuration, the same system in large file copies, showed terrible write speeds and overall system performance, et cetera, et cetera. So a Vertex 2 is a high-performance SandForce based SSD. A single one of those is going to give you great performance. If you try to RAID two of them together in a RAID 0 array, you are going to be bottlenecked by the controller, especially on an NVIDIA 680i motherboard, which is somewhat old. The only time, so he talks about the option of buying an expensive add-on RAID card, RAID controller card, that you'll see benefits of, but do you really want to spend $500 on that? Probably not. If you have a newer motherboard with a SATA 6 chipset, even Intel's new ICH11, I guess, or whatever they're calling it on the H67 chipsets, they have two channels of SATA 6 on there. If you use SATA 6 enabled SSDs, you would see improvements. I was trying to think if maybe if the bus between each of those channels went back differently to the controller. But I'm not sure.
If you're in super nerd mode and you want to, you know, if you're thinking like, gosh, I don't feel like overclocking the 6,000 hertz with liquid nitrogen, but I would like to do a serious high-end performance project. Yes. Right. Your RAID 5 configuration on the system was a function of RAID 5 write slow, you know, without having a special controller with a big chunk of cache and a well-managed bus. RAID 5 is not particularly practical for using as a desktop drive. It reads better than it writes. You know, that's why your large file copies were showing terrible write speeds, because there's a lot of math in you know, striping the data and doing all the other parity information for a RAID 5. People call me foolish, but I'm just not into RAID 0.
and I think it's – I mean, you'll see some performance benefits, but if you RAID 0 to SSDs, you're going to see like maximum read speed increase, maximum write speed increase, but that's not really where your performance benefit is seen in SSD. You know, we reiterate it all the time that it's in the random access times is where the real benefits of SSDs go. If you need more than 200 megabytes per second reads and writes, then you're doing more than we're doing. And we do a lot of computing.
I would think like, man, for the price of a second hard drive, you could upgrade your motherboard or upgrade your CPU or upgrade your motherboard and your CPU and your memory and get much more out of your overall system than you will out of strapping two RAID drives into a RAID 0 configuration. Unless you're doing something really crazy. I met somebody who built, I want to say, a half a petaflop, half a petabyte, not flop, SSD, gigantic SSD RAID storage system for a here-to-be-unnamed government agency. And I was sitting there like, you have data issues, dude.
I believe I know this person.
I believe you do, too. It was an awesome conversation. I want to get him to talk about it, but... you know, it's...
Government,
it's,
blah, blah.
Yeah, if Ryan and Patrick are gone next week, you know, we said too much. But yeah, I would get a faster motherboard. I'd get a faster chip. I would take advantage of the single drive performance. Or do the RAID 5 out of SSD drives.
Hey, go suck it up. Buy two drives, not one more. Buy five drives.
That's going to call it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Mr. Shroud is at Ryan Shroud. I'm at Patrick Norton. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. Ryan, what's coming up on PC Per this week?
It's almost like a quiet period after the storm of CES. We do have a lot of cool stuff coming up. There's going to be new graphics cards released. There's a review up of a single slot GeForce GTX 460 we didn't talk about today, but you might want to check that out as well if you're interested in home theater PC goodness with lots of stuff. And hopefully we'll have some of our hands on these Tegra 2 goodies in the next 10 to 14 days.
Yeah, I definitely want to get my hands on some of the Tegra 2 powered stuff or talk to somebody who has. We've got actually Robert Herring coming up on Monday talking about Sandy Bridge performance and encoding. More importantly, whether or not it's a proper home theater PC chip. The answer on that one may surprise you. And boy, do we have a lot of questions about smart PCs. We've got a Marantz demo of Boat Boy. We got Marantz running the new Apple software that was kind of fun to watch. All those moments when like a really easy brand name goes far, far away. AirPlay. Could a brand name be simpler? We got AirPlay running on Marantz, which is also on Denon. And you know, for anybody out there who's a FreeBSD enthusiast who's familiar with running multiple Samba clients in jails on FreeBSD, do me a favor, watch Techzilla coming out on Monday because we've got a question for you on the show that I am desperate for an answer on.
FreeBSD.
Oh, man. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
That's another Twitch. Another Twitch is in the can. I just did the world's worst Leo imitation there. I'd like to apologize to everyone listening, especially those of you in the chat room who are probably mocking me with good reason right now.